Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
Okay, girls, today I'm giving you the inside scoop on my favorite place to save this spring. At Ross, it's the spot to get everything you need at prices you'll love. Because when you find brand names for 20 to 60% off other retailers' prices, you'll definitely be finding your next favorite outfit and more. Trust me, you don't want to miss out on these deals on your favorite dresses and tops. And at this price, you might as well throw in a new purse or pair of shoes too. But Ross isn't just about savings. They're about giving back. This year, Ross and their customers raised over $4.1 million to support the Boys and Girls Clubs and local youth programs to help kids and families thrive. Seriously, just visit your local Ross and see for yourself. Because I know you like to keep your closet full and your costs low. So what are you waiting for? Say yes for less at your local Ross.
Plan on flying? It's time to upgrade to a real ID. Because in order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID, or you'll need another acceptable form of identification. So don't wait. Find out how to get your real ID at tsa.gov/realid. That's tsa.gov/realid. Or visit your local DMV. And then you'll be cleared for takeoff.
Welcome to the Lorehounds. I'm your host, David. Welcome to a special podcast about the movie Dune 2. Today with me are Anthony, Alicia, and Ron. We're going to get into a full spoiler conversation about the movie right from the start. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, you know, pause it, go and see it, and then come back.
Right now.
Right now. Literally right now.
You know, just to reiterate on this.
Yeah.
Not being a book reader, there were a few moments in this film that I just jaw-dropping surprise. And
yes.
So if you don't want to ruin those things for yourself, then just, you know, the podcast will wait. We'll just hang out here and you can press pause and go watch the movie.
That's right.
Can't wait to find out what those surprises were for you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going to start off really quick with just a round robin of initial impressions. And then we're going to talk mostly about the movie itself for the first part of the conversation. And then we'll slowly expand wider and wider into the book and extended universe related stuff. If you need to get in touch with us, lorehounds@thelorehounds.com, or visit us on our website. And there's contact form and voicemail feature there. We have our Discord where we've got a lot of lively conversations happening, especially around Shogun right now, which is what our active show is. Links for all of that stuff are in the show notes, especially for our affiliate podcasts. We have Alicia and Anthony here with us today. They both have their own podcast. Marilyn has a podcast, Rings and Rituals, going right now. So if you want to hear those, go to those links and subscribe separately. So let's spin the wheel here and get everybody's initial impressions. Anthony, do you want to lead us off? Just a few words about how this movie left you feeling.
Yeah, I was floored, amazed, in awe, in a state of blissful wonderment at the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
As that was my introduction.
You mean Dune 1 or the first time you saw Dune 2?
The 2021,
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. 2021. That one was just one of the most amazing theater experiences I've ever had in my life. So I was really built up for this. And sometimes when you're built up for something, it kind of disappoints. This one did not disappoint. I loved this even more. I mean, I walked out of the theater thinking that might be the best sequel I've ever seen in a theater.
Mm.
So that, I mean, amazed, loved this movie.
Great. Ron, where are you at? And I know you just saw it for a second time last night. I did also as well.
Yeah, this movie is the reason why we make movies.
I think. Mm-hmm.
Firing on all cylinders. And I saw a lot of reviews going before it. The TikTokers and the YouTubers, like, just over the moon. And I was concerned that it can never live up to live up to the hype.
Right.
And the way I describe it is, depending on your familiarity with the books and the story, how you feel at the end of this film, because I think a lot of ways how a person feels about a movie is largely determined by how well it sticks the landing. Like, I've gone to movies, they are kind of as I'm watching it, but then they stick the landing so well, I have a great experience with the overall movie.
Mm.
And so depending on a person's experience with the books may inform how excited they are about this movie when they come out of it. Mm-hmm. But just as a cinematic experience, it is just everything. The music, the sound design, the acting, it is not hyperbole to say it is epic, and it is easily one of the best sequels put to cinema.
I agree.
I mean, I think it's hard to argue that it's not.
I walked out of the theater stumbling, kind of in a stupor. Like, I didn't understand what was going on emotionally inside of me. I hadn't felt, I don't think I can, I think maybe Aliens is one of the few movies that has done this to me, where I've walked out of the movie, just my whole physical being, my mind, my spirit, just vibrating.
Yeah.
The kinetic energy of that movie was incredible. You know, with Dune 2, I just walked out in wonderment, and I literally was like almost stumbling to my car as I was trying to get myself home. And I didn't know that, I forgot that a movie could do that to me, that a film could be this expansive. And that's not to say I don't have some nitpicks and some minor criticisms of the film. And I saw it again last night, and the feels hit me in different places this time, because I was obviously expecting it a little bit, so my mindset was different. But I think, Ron, I was a similar thing. I was like, how can this movie live up? These people are talking just crazy, right? This is just normal marketing, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, I'll just manage my expectations. And when Chani and Paul first kiss, that for me, from that in, I was just in. Or when the Harkonnens were floating up the rock, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And then the body's dropping. But then when they kissed, I was like, oh, wait, what is this movie doing to me? I was really, really confused. So I think I agree with both of your assessments that this is probably one of the best sequels that's ever been made. And this is a film that I just don't even know how to process at this point, what it did to me. Alicia, you want to anchor us? What did you, where are your feelings and thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, so I had mixed feelings about Dune Part 1, because I am coming at it as someone who's like obsessively read the books and stuff. So I struggled with some of the choices that he made. And also, so going into this one, we had just heard the whole interview with Villeneuve saying about how he hates dialogue and stuff. I was like, oh, well, that was the problem with the first movie. And then I hear we're in full spoiler territory, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, safety's
so
off.
I hear about the part about like Aaliyah not being born in the movie and not doing the iconic thing she does at the end of the book. And so I went in like, you know, I'm hearing all the raves, but I'm just kind of grumpy about it. And then that moment where the Harkonnens lift off, every hair on my body stood on end.
What's the word for that?
horripilate.
Yes, that's right.
And full horripilation. And I just knew I was in, and I didn't look at my watch through the whole 3-hour thing, except that's not completely true. I looked at it to time my drink intake so okay. that I didn't have to go to the bathroom. But I was just, regularly like all my hair standing on end. And I came to understand, I understand the adaptation choices made, and mm-hmm. some of them I really love, I think are better than the book in some cases. I think that the Fremen have never been so well brought to life. And it's just, it's just as a cinematic experience and as an adaptation, it fires on all cylinders, and I'm already like throwing all the Oscars at it from next year. I'm like, I don't care what comes out.
Above the line, below the line.
Yeah.
really quick, it makes, maybe makes a little sense for us to consider, who's read and seen what. I've read all the core 6 books. I've never read any of his son's adapted extended mm-hmm. universe. And I've seen the 84 movie, but I didn't see the sci-fi special. And 84 has a special place in my heart. And then, I've seen Dune 1, I don't know how many times, and Dune 2 now a couple mm-hmm. times. Ron, have you read any of the books, or where are you at with your Dune history?
Yeah, I probably read a third of the first book, but I've watched and devoured every YouTube video about okay. all the books.
So you watch Quinn's ideas? Quinn has a lot of,
I've watched Quinn's ideas and filmic comic something or other. Anyway, there are a number of video essays, 30, 40 minute video essays on all the books. So I devoured all of those. So I feel like I've read all the books.
The Cliff Notes version, right? The exactly. modern Cliff Notes version.
Right.
Yeah. Alicia?
And I was going to say, and I too... I don't know if the 84 movie has a special place in my heart, but I remember seeing it in the theater. I remember liking it, and I enjoyed it. And I think I watched the special TV series version of it when it came out.
The sci-fi.
Whenever it did. Yeah, the sci-fi a while ago.
Okay.
So, that's my familiarity.
Alicia?
So I came into it through, my mom really loved it. She saw the 84 movie when I was a baby. And so then she went and she read all the books. She also read all the Sun's books up to that time, but she got me into, Frank Herbert's books. And so I've read those, but I've read, the earlier it is in the series, the more I've read it. So,
right. Okay.
My favorite 2 books are, of course, the first 2, this one and Dune Messiah, which will be the one adapted for the next Dune Part 3.
Yeah, and the books are really up and down, aren't they? There's some that are just amazing, and then some.
I mean, they get weird, which I like as, but I some of the later books I like better as abstract concepts rather than spending all the hours you need to spend to read these books.
Right.
Like, it's better at a top level thing. You're just like, that's an interesting concept. Let's consider that.
Anthony?
Yeah, not a book reader at this point. I loved the first movie. I love to hate the 84 movie. I think I will probably pick up the books this summer, maybe, if I have got some time in my schedule. I might ask you all to alert me if you're going to spoil something big about the next film. I might just... plug my ears for 10 seconds or whatever. Otherwise I'm so into this story. I'm loving it as a film iteration.
Your first love is film, Anthony, I think you have said that before. As a cinematic experience, I mean, we've all been gushing now for the last few minutes about how great this film is. I see a note here that you have about the screen, like what screen have you seen it on and what's the impact of that? What are your thoughts on that? Were you able to see it on a large screen, 70 or IMAX or?
Yeah, I saw it opening day on IMAX, and it was a relatively full theater that I think that changes the experience. Blown away, just breathtaking. And then yesterday, my son saw it midweek, and he just wouldn't stop talking about it. So it was like day 3 of him monologuing about Paul Atreides. And I was like, you know what? Let's go see it. I've got a podcast about this tomorrow. We should just
perfect
go see it together. And I saw it on a standard. So my son saw it on IMAX. I saw it on IMAX. Then we saw it on a standard screen. And we both realized it was a different experience. It just felt different.
Uh-huh.
And of course, the second viewing sometimes doesn't quite do it. But I'm wondering if this is the kind of film, because I've talked to a lot of people that are like, well, I'll wait for it to, you know, come out on Apple TV or something. And I keep saying, no, you have to see it in the theater. Yeah. But there are very few films where that's actually true about, I think. But this is like, I really think that this is going to have two different audiences. I think the people that watch it on the small screen will not have the same experience. And they'll have a different feeling walking away from this movie than the people who kind of made the effort, paid a little bit of money to see it on in the theater.
Or had access. Yeah, yeah, like I don't even have it. We don't have a big screen like that here where I live. So I
kind of feel like it's an interesting problem for a film that just knocks it out of the park for that, you know, primo experience. Anyway, that's my thought on this.
Yeah. Alicia, Ron, do you guys have thoughts about screen and viewing?
Yeah, I think movies are a full experience. They're a full sensory experience. And some movies take advantage of all the senses.
Mm.
Some movies, you really pretty much just need to see it and hear the dialogue. And that's, in order for it to, you know, to really hit. What's that movie where the two people are just talking, Wallace Shawn?
My Dinner with Andre. Yeah.
Class. You don't need to see My Dinner with Andre on IMAX, right? Okay. That's not something you need to see on a three-story tall building.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to movies like Dune or Lord of the Rings or any of these epic sagas, there is something about the surround sound experience, 5.1, 7.1, 14.3, whatever it is. I just made up that last number. There is something about seeing the size and the resolution. I mean, seeing those three giant worms come at you on a 3-foot tall screen is going to be completely different than seeing them come at you on a 47-inch television, right?
Across the room while your kids are screaming. And
Exactly. And so, yeah, it's undeniable that the visceral experience you get from being in a theater, particularly if you're able to experience the rumble and feel it in your seats and to see the size of the mountains and the monsters on a tall screen, is going to have an impact on how you come away from the film. And you might miss things on a smaller screen that you won't miss on a bigger screen. So there's that as well.
Yeah, I think there's also, I had to go to the smaller screen this time just because protecting my ears and for having a broken leg. I had to go to this one theater with the crappy sound and the smaller screens. And that was the thing while I was watching the whole time, I was like, oh man, I wish I were at the Dolby Theater for this one. Mm-hmm. But the other aspect of this, it's not just about the quality, the size of the visuals and the quality of the sound. It's also about the communal experience, you know, being there and having people sniffling all together at the same scenes and, you know, cheering occasionally and just gasping and showing it's an experience that we're all going through together. And that definitely adds something too.
Mm-hmm. I think with the world building too, one of the things that I feel that Villeneuve has gotten right is scale. He understands scale. He understands the scale of Arrakis and the worms and the spice and the carryalls and the spice harvesters. And he knows how to use the camera to give us the scale. There's a lot of intimate shots, but then there's a lot of wide shots where we see the rolling dunes or we see the spice haulers moving around and then people in relationship to those kinds of things. And I think seeing it, there's only that first time that you can see this movie. And I couldn't, yeah, like I said, we don't have a 70 or an IMAX nearby where I can conveniently get to it. And I couldn't wait multiple days to, I couldn't turn myself off from the internet to schedule myself to go do it. But there's just your first time of being able to see this movie and to be taken by the world building as Villeneuve envisioned it in his mind's eye, in his director's eye, on a 3-foot screen or a 70 millimeter screen. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important part of the Dune story is the scale of things too. Because you're not just talking about, oh, well, here's a little person next to a big old spice crawler machine or what have you. But Paul is thinking when he becomes the Kwisatz Haderach, he becomes galaxy brained, literally. He sees all these futures and he sees all these pasts. And yet he's still a mortal man. He's still a little man in a little body. And so that sense of scale, I think, plays in other indirect ways with the story.
What do you think about the comments about going in where he said, you know, he's such a visual storyteller, and he made the comments that may have been misinterpreted, I think, after watching the movie about dialogue not being as important. But I do think that there were some iconic dialogues also in this film.
I actually didn't hear that interview, but I've heard a lot of people mention it and comment on it. I don't know to what extent people overreacted to what he said, but I think we have all marveled. Who hasn't marveled at the beginning of Up, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many times have people talked about the power and emotion of the beginning of that Pixar movie? The entire opening, there is no dialogue, but the story comes through. As a filmmaker, I remember watching, I didn't watch it as a filmmaker, but I remember watching it as a kid and having a new experience for it when I became a filmmaker, The Red Balloon. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen the short film, The Red Balloon, it's a French film that came out, I don't know,
it's lovely.
In the 60s.
Childhood, yeah,
classic. It's about a little kid who befriends this red balloon. This balloon takes on a life of itself. And you're crying at the end of that film. There's no dialogue in it. And so I think, and you know, for years there were silent films. So I didn't hear the interview, but my guess is, knowing the kind of filmmaker that Denis Villeneuve is, that his point was that sometimes dialogue can be an obstacle to emotion.
Mm.
That the filmmaker can better express through just visuals.
I think he as a filmmaker can do that. But for instance, like Justine Triet, you know, from mm-hmm. The Anatomy of a Fall filmmaker, her dialogue is her bread and butter, and that's what makes her film so great. So I think maybe that's why it came off so poorly to some people, is because it's just like, well, who are you to say how film should be made or something? That's, yeah.
Now, was he saying dialogue in general is not important? Or?
He said that it's better for TV, it's not for film or something. But that's, I think it's maybe misinterpreted. You know, he's French. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, that feels, I have to watch it, so I can't comment on it.
Mm-hmm.
But even when I think about, you know, his films are very visual, without a doubt. I think of Sicario and some of the vistas that you see in Sicario.
Mm.
And of course, I mean, Arrival is just mm-hmm. a visual sight mm-hmm. as well. But I think he uses dialogue. Some of the lines in Arrival are really powerful, mm-hmm. really emotional and moving. And so
he's great doing adaptations, I think.
Yeah. So I would, and I think to your point, Lisa, even in this movie, Dune 2, you know, a lot of the dialogue we hear is powerful. When Paul's addressing the Fremen, and he's saying "Long live the fighters" or whatever however that mm-hmm. line goes, that's really powerful. The funny, I think the only aspects of comedy that come through this are from Stilgar's comments,
mm-hmm.
And you know, that's all delivered through dialogue. I think obviously dialogue is important, and it depends on the film. It really depends on the film.
Yeah. I notice in one key scene, he stopped even the music when we have Paul and Fed Rautha fighting at the end. And I found that a really powerful choice, you know, that use of silence.
Oh, I didn't notice. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, because there's a lot of music that's used effectively throughout the movie to really set mood.
I just posted a video about Hans Zimmer talking about making the music on the Discord, if anyone wants to see it. Yeah.
Anthony, did you find that Villeneuve's color grading and visual aesthetic worked for you for this movie? I had a little bit of problem with it in Dune Part 1.
All right. Number one, shooting on location with natural light. And I know that was really important for him. It just makes so much of a difference.
Mm.
It makes just so much of a difference. And so any scene on the sand works fantastic for me. I did like the sense that if you go off world to a different planet, the light is a little bit different. Like when you're on the Imperial, in the Imperial courtyard or the Imperial palace, the lighting is just a little bit less oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when you go to the Black Sun planet, everything's black and white.
Giddy brand. Yeah. Actually, if I can interrupt you slightly,
I noticed this
last night. When they're in interiors of buildings on Giddy Prime, they're in color.
That's right.
And they only go to a black and white when
under the direct sunlight.
Correct. Right? And apparently that was shot on IR, on infrared film, and not in black and white. And that's what gives it its really unique
interesting
look. Yeah.
All right. So I was wondering about that as sort of a theme for, you know, sort of a little, maybe a little bit too much for me in that case. But that might be just the way that I'm kind of receiving the Harkonnen, culture at large or something like that. But I was quite impressed with that aspect of the film. I was thinking in terms of like the way that you tell a story relative to dialogue. Light is another way you can tell a story on screen. But the question for me is like, what is the film trying to do? So like some film theory would say something like, did the film have a big idea? You know, that's what people are looking for.
Right.
Or another way into this is to say, you know, did the director have a point of view? And did he communicate here? Did he or she communicate the point of view?
Mm-hmm.
But the one that always sticks with me is the grand question, did the film make you feel something?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, this film made me feel everything. So like, I absolutely felt, you know, the call to arms in the speech. I absolutely felt that, you know, young love, that powerful, visceral feeling of young love, or the feeling of, you know, a son and his mother at odds, or the catharsis of, you know, seeing someone you thought was dead, who's now alive, or just the sense of vengeance, that visceral feeling that you want to avenge. Mm-hmm. I mean, this film told the story so effectively through the feeling of it that I didn't need like the 84 version, like to hear the dialogue in their head, you know, sort of like the whispered inner thoughts of that. I didn't need that in this, because if the director's good enough at what is it with the method that's being used, the visuals can tell the story, and light is one way to do that. And I did like it quite a bit.
Ron and Alicia, I'm curious with you guys, since Ron, you're a Cliff Notes reader, and Alicia, like I, has read the books multiple times. With what Anthony was just saying there, with the one big idea, did you guys feel like you picked up on the big idea? And if so, what was it in this movie? Because I'm like Anthony a little bit, where I felt everything. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of what made me feel for this particular movie was the fact of the actual realization of taking how I felt in the books and putting that on screen. And so I was really responding emotionally to the adaptation. And in large part, not having any problems with Denis' point of view and his creative choices. But in terms of big ideas, I don't know, Alicia and Ron, where are you guys with that? Did the movie work for you from a big idea, like Anthony was just laying out, like a from a big idea standpoint? Did you pick up on it?
I think it's hard not to separate it. It's hard to separate it from the big conversation that's been following, which is the whole white savior idea. I don't know if you agree, Ron, if that's been a conversation you've been hearing a lot since, but now that's sort of dominating my head. Yeah.
It's interesting you say that. So I have some thoughts about the white savior conversation because I've definitely been hearing it. And I do not think this is a white savior movie.
No.
Yeah. And I'll explain why.
Explicitly made not to be in the books. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, without spoiling too much, it's clear from what happens in the following books.
Right.
I will inject a slight historical note. As I understand it, though, too, and this I could be wrong on this understanding, was that Herbert was playing with that trope at one level. But there's so much more going on in terms of sociology and religion and psychology and ecology. And it wasn't until later when everybody started writing letters to him in the 60s when this came out. And they're like, are you starting a cult? Are you starting a new movement? Are you starting? And he like got inundated with this feedback of like, oh, what is this Herbert guy up to? Like some people wanted to join his cult. Some people were like trying to find out more information. And so he wrote the books later to over accentuate the tearing down of the Messiah idea. Right. And so that's why Messiah and children go the way that they go in the books.
Well, yeah, I mean, you see it already in the first book with just, and this is something that the movie rightfully focuses on, it's the fact that the Bene Gesserit implanted this propaganda.
The Missionary Protectiva. Yeah.
To in order to benefit on it later. And
all planets. They've done this all over.
Right. All over the place. But Dune is a place where it will especially take hold because the people are living such a tough life there. It's, you know. It's there in the first book. But indeed, yeah, what I've heard is that like when he saw people's responses to that, he's like, no, wait, people didn't get it. I think I have to go harder on this.
Yeah. And for me, given the kind of content I make, because I make a lot of content that's geared towards, you know, as you know, David, you know, my particular journey of faith and how I moved from being a devout Christian to now being an agnostic atheist and how and why I went in that direction and the kind of content that I create around that, it is impossible for me to come out of this movie and not hear loud and clear the dangers. And there are a couple of lines that Chinese says that are this that just to me scream so like Christian nationalism or the dangers of any kind of, you know, dogmatic religion. Like they use prophecies to control you. And
Johnny's explicit with some of those things. Yeah, absolutely. She's
very much on the nose. And so when I hear
that was
those,
a very good change, I think. But
Those are very when I hear those from the movie, that's something I relate to. Just, you know, the fundamentalism of Stilgar and the Fremen from the South, how they convince themselves of, like all the ways they convince themselves of something that they already believe. This is something I see in religion all the time. And the point you made, Alicia, like how this is something that was implanted in this culture. Like it was purposely put there, planted almost like by Inception, calling another amazing filmmaker, for it to fester and grow over how many millennia or whatever.
Well, and fed because the Bene Gesserit are present on Arrakis.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And keep these certain things alive. And just for non-book readers, the Missionary Protectiva is manufactured mythology that the Bene Gesserit literally install like a piece of software, like a boot driver or something, into cultures all over the galaxy so that if one of the Bene Gesserit sisters is ever in need or needs to shape the outcome of something or is in a danger position, they have a whole toolkit available to them that are pre-installed in that culture. so they can use phrases and words and mannerisms and pointing to other mythologies.
The prophecy. It's the prophecy.
It's the prophecy. Or, yeah. a great one from Tintin was, when dealing with quote unquote savage tribes and there's a full solar eclipse and it's like, oh, I can use the solar eclipse as my get out of jail card, or C-3PO with the Ewoks. Right.
Oh, right.
Great. So the missionary protectiva is installed across the world. And so I think it plays an interesting thing. The fact that how do we end up with a true Messiah, quote unquote, true Messiah, when this is a manufactured thing, but mm-hmm. at the end of the day, Paul can see.
But it is manufactured in a genetic way too. Like it's not just they're laying, the software and creating the hardware to plug into it.
Yeah.
No, that's a good point. And I also can't help but think about when I go back to how the role that Christianity has played in terms of injecting itself in different cultures, you can't help but wonder what kind of religion or culture would have developed on Fremen, on Dune, among the Fremen, if they didn't have, this Bene Gesserit, prophecy instilled. Oftentimes, one conversation that's popular among the African American community, the Black community, is the role that the church has played in our community with regards to both the bad and the good. The mm-hmm. church has done a lot of bad things, to the Black community. Like there's no denying for years, the Bible was used to substantiate, slavery and racism. Mm-hmm. By the same token, the church is also a place they did a lot of work in the civil rights movement for Black people. So, but there's a lot of conversation about, how did Christianity come to Africa? And a lot of people will say that Christianity was forced on the slaves. But there were some aspects of Ethiopia where Christianity, was evolving and, mm-hmm. and growing, even before the slave trade. But even that, in a sense, was, I don't know if implanted is the right word, but it wasn't necessarily, it wasn't something that grew out of natural African cultures.
Culture.
Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, by definition, it came from outside of Africa. And a lot of the African cultures and religions were suppressed on both sides of the continent. And I remember as a kid, I went to this all-Black school. It was an African school. And I remember, and my mom was like a Southern Baptist, so I grew up Christian, whatever. But I remember I had this one class in the school where they taught us about all the African gods. And I remember as a kid trying to wrestle our idea with, how does the one main god fit in with all these African gods? So I always thought of the one mm-hmm. main god as like the main god, the king god, and all the other mm-hmm. gods were like his generals or something. Like that's how my mind played with it. But it is this idea of what would of all these planets, what kind of cultures and religions would have grown out
right.
of these planets if the Bene Gesserit weren't there. Manipulating it all.
Yeah.
Right.
Anthony, as a religion person who has or their profession, his study of religion.
Yeah.
How did you respond? Do you think the Muad'Dib, the Mahdi story played well here? Was it earned? Did Paul's ascension work for you?
I mean, as someone who is trying to do some kind of sci-fi realism, which I'm assuming is sort of Frank Herbert's, one of the things that he's trying to do is he's trying to create a realistic political paradigm.
Right. Yeah.
One that absolutely. Can be believed, even if it is intergalactic and not simply, Earth focused. What you do, if you want that, is you have to study how politics works here and now, right? Because your audience is here and now. So is religion a part of politics on this planet? Absolutely. And you could, it's almost impossible to imagine political systems without an element of religious influence. You could almost, you could almost imagine politics emerging from a religious perspective in the ancient world. So for him to reflect reality, the religious reality of Earth, and I think you've got a lot of Islam also baked into his world building.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do think that there's some interesting parallels to Eastern Buddhism as well. I'm not quite the right person to talk to about that, but I detected a bit of that too. But absolutely, that adds to the texture of this. And I'm thinking specifically of how you feel the nuance in the Fremen culture, that it's not simply one kind of religion, but it's different iterations of this culture that are reacting to the religion. So you've got the fundamentalists in the South, and then what is a Shoni's tribe called? I forget what it's called.
Well, it's Siege Tabor. Well, they changed
Siege Tabor. Yeah.
They say it differently in the movie.
I don't know.
Siege Tabor.
But I thought it was I thought it was really well done to show that there's a conflict even within the culture, and there's similarities. You know, this culture is entirely built around the paucity of water, and so all of the tradition, the kind of animals that they venerate,
beautiful rituals around death, the way that they extract water.
Exactly.
Wow, that was amazing.
All of that is just so well told. But then to show but we disagree on the Messiah because that's a dangerous idea. Or the other side of it is like, why don't you look at him? He's exhibiting all of the signs. It's been written.
He's an ugly guy.
You not see that he's the Messiah? So to me, that texture feels very, very real. Mm-hmm. And so well done. And so few sci-fis actually take the religious elements of
seriously. These
kinds of cultures seriously. So I really appreciated that in this movie.
I think it's really interesting, and I'm curious, Alicia, what you thought, the choice that Villeneuve made in creating a multifaceted Fremen culture as compared to the books, where it's very mono. There are no northern and southern, which is a very interesting thing too, also to mirror our own world, sort of north, south, the crazy fundamentalists are all in the south or whatever. They're lesser developed. We're more advanced or cosmopolitan.
I was literally just going to ask about that, if that was something.
Not at all in the books. There's no fractioning. Am I right in that, Alicia?
I think most notably, one of the good adaptation choices, I think, is to give Chani more agency. Like in the books, Chani is kind of immediately like, oh, big Messiah hero dude. Yay. I'm totally on board with all the messed up shit you're going to do. Right. And this is definitely, I like that she comes from this more, I guess, because they're southern and they're closer to the cities. They're more kind of
they're jaded. Closer to Arakeen. Yeah, I believe canonically, Siege Tabor is closer to Arakeen at the city.
Yeah, itself. So they're more like they've interact more with outsiders, and presumably they're more jaded in a way, more
cosmopolitan.
Yeah, and I think it makes. I'm not going to give any spoilers for the next book, but it makes what's coming so much more fraught too.
As I'm thinking about it I think Messiah and maybe a little bit in Children of Dune, Herbert does touch on, and I believe even in the first book, he touches a little bit of a difference between Fremen who live in Arakeen versus people who live out, but it's more of a country versus city.
Like they're softer when they live in the city. Yeah,
exactly.
Which is absolutely reflective of the world we're living in, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I thought Shani was almost a stand-in for the audience experience. I mean, if you think about her, she's open. She's open to Paul Atreides. She's not as cynical as her friend. She is still a bit jaded, but she ends up embracing him in the way the audience is embracing him. If you think about her accent, she doesn't really have one.
Right.
She really kind of is almost a modern teenager who's happens to be in this world and giving us all of the cues that you would expect in a way that kind of, she's almost a bridge between the alien world that's being created and the world of the audience, I thought. And I thought it
was interesting,
quite effective.
Yeah. That's an interesting point.
It's funny you bring up her lack of accent. I remember hearing on another podcast, they were talking about how Paul and Chani just sound like Timothy and Zendaya.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Totally.
Whereas everyone else has some kind of accent going on. Whether or not it's an accent that would, you know, do they have British accents on Dune? Kind of, I don't know.
They all kind of speak their own, in their own voices, except for, of course, and always, Austin Butler is going to go all
just going to bring him up.
You know what? He kills it. Let him do his voices.
If you close your eyes, he sounds like Stellan.
Right. Yeah. Yes, I think that's intentional. Fade is taking on the Baron, tone of the Baron.
And the movie actually does call this out. Like, it's a little bit of a joke, but it's like, you can't hear that he has got a different accent. You know, they're talking about Stilgar. Like,
Paul
doesn't know he's from the South. He's like,
you can't hear his accent.
Yeah. It was almost sort of like, it works in world because it does highlight that Paul's an outsider, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Like, but it also works for the audience because if you wanted to, nitpick, no, they've already solved that problem. They're from different regions, different Fremen, have different accents. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate it.
Good world building. Yeah.
Yeah.
My biggest complaint of Dune 1 was the diction, was the fact that House Atreides is a noble house. And so by that regard, they would have some way of verbally differentiating themselves from other people. So that really bothered me. But in this movie, it never really bothered me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was because Villeneuve primed the, dialogue doesn't matter, conversation, or the fact that it just didn't really matter in this film. It didn't matter to the, it was a plot. It's a technical detail that is so minor in comparison to everything else that was going on. I'm curious though, too, as to get maybe some more movie nuts and bolts. How did everybody feel about the casting? Did everything in the casting work for everyone? Like for me, I love me some Christopher Walken, but Lisa, it didn't work.
I laughed every single time. I was like,
"Oh, you did?
Dude, you're not even going to try?" Like,
speaking of people talking like themselves.
Exactly.
I'm almost thinking all right, first off, Dave Bautista's yell acting, like it just too much. Like your Dave Bautista has to just be over the top in every scene. It was laughable. Like my son and I were like just laughing at Dave Bautista.
He did have some good wounded puppy dog looks though in this movie. So
I guess, but I'm thinking
he was healed.
If you put Dave Bautista in the same movie as Christopher Walken, and one of them only can ever shout his lines, and the other one is like barely phoning it in, I'm thinking, come on, are you guys in the same movie here?
Right.
I loved the acting. I thought that was really well done. I just every now and again it'd be like, oh gosh, Dave Bautista or Christopher Walken just seem like two ends of a spectrum on this one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's interesting you bring up the casting. I personally thought the acting was top notch. I thought they did a really good job. I really do feel for Chani's character. I do feel the conflict that Paul's going through. I still have to think about his turn. Is it too quick? Because he was so against going to the South. Mm-hmm. And the one vision from Jonas is what convinces him. Either that or realizing that the North wasn't going to follow him. They weren't going to do what they needed to do unless he went to the South. That's the impression that I got.
This has been a big topic of conversation. I've heard a lot of people ask, is the shift in Paul's character well earned?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, I think that's legit. My girlfriend, she loved the movie. She saw it for the first time last night when we saw it together. And one point that she made was she felt like she wasn't as invested. Like, she loved the movie. She thought it was great. Uh-huh. But she didn't feel as invested in the characters as she does in other movies that she watches. And it was hard for her to put the her finger on it. She felt invested in Fade Ratha, and she felt in Stilgar. Like, those are two characters for her. But the way she described it was some of the other characters felt flat. That was how she described it. She felt like Chani and Paul felt a little flat. Your thoughts on that, the differences between the performances or those particular characters. And I think it has something to do with the personalities that you see come out in those two in particular. But I was wondering what you all thought.
Well, I have a question, because so I thought, like David, I thought that I'm not like a Zendaya or a Timothée Chalamet fan in general. Like, this is only the second thing I've liked Timothée Chalamet in. The first
was Dune.
No. But I felt like, David, that their chemistry really worked for me in this one. And like when they had that kiss on top of the dune, get it? I was really sold on it. And I thought the chemistry was great. And I thought, you know, just showing them waking up in the tent together, and you get this idea that they've just been living as a couple. And it feels, as you said, so modern, like it could just be people I know today. Yeah. That really worked for me. But I know for other people, my friends did not think that they had any chemistry, and they they were complaining about her turn at the end, about, you know, she's like, well, I'm serving my group, not not my boyfriend. And then she's like, but then she goes to fight with them. I'm like, well, yeah, but that was in service of the Fremen, rather than in service of Paul, I think. And then, of course, yeah, people are mad at Paul at the end, but they should be.
I think something that's missing from the Chani conversation, and as a deviation, you know, in that idea of adaptation versus inspiration. And then we talk about the Shippey test, right? The Tom Shippey's idea that, you know, you've got medium and message. Like, did as a creator or a filmmaker, you have to change or move something to be able to make the plot work and still hit the message that the original creator meant. I think Chani's turn away, it's one of the strongest things that Villeneuve does in terms of moving away from the original story. But it works, and I don't have a problem with it. And I think it gives him different choices when he makes the next movie. The thing that I think is missing from conversation, though, is the fact that Paul is now omniscient. He can see everything. He literally can see centuries into the future at this point. And he can see the path of humanity. And that's what his whole wrestling was up until this point, that he knows that what's called the Golden Path in the later books is a very narrow and precarious path. And it requires a whole bunch of stuff. And it requires an insane transformation later on down the road, to be able to shepherd humanity through this sort of dark age, which is an interesting thing, because when we talk about big science fiction stories, we had Foundation prior to this and the fall of a galactic empire. Frank Herbert is absolutely writing this story in the shadow of Asimov's work. I mean, they're still contemporaries, I believe, at this point. And then, of course, we get into, you know, where Star Wars borrowed from all of this as well. But this idea that Paul can see all of these infinite futures, and there's this one path. So he can see Chani's path, and he understands already he's made the full commitment into being Messiah, not just for the Fremen, but for the entirety of humanity. And so he's balancing his Paul, Duke of Atreides, I love this person, to the fact that now he's literally a galaxy brain. And that he's got more than just that to see. So
I wonder if that was conveyed well enough, because maybe that'll be something that the next movie will do better. But, you know, I'm thinking of like Bran Stark, when Bran ends up like tapping into the Weirwood tree network, becomes a three-eyed crow, the three-eyed raven in the show. He almost loses a bit of his humanity. He loses the importance of his personal connections. You know, it's like, The people in his life are much less important, because he's more like a god than he is a human. And because the scale of his perception has just exploded so much.
This is exactly the same. Oh my God. I didn't even think about brand connection in here. This
but
is exactly
in the show, you know, that actor portrays that as just becoming kind of robotic and wooden
because
he just doesn't have the connections to these characters anymore. But when I look at Paul Atreides toward the end of this movie, he's still acting as if the relationships in his life matter in a way that you wouldn't expect of someone with galaxy brain.
Right.
And so to me, that was crucial for how I received that near to the last scene where he tells her, I will love you as long as I breathe, and then turns around and doesn't just propose, but demands the hand. I demand, you know, I will take the hand of your daughter and we will rule together. It's a demand for marriage more than anything else. And I'm sitting there with, you know, looking at this scene through Chani's eyes, thinking,
right,
oh my gosh, that was one of those jaw-dropping moments where I was just like, I can't believe what I'm watching. But that scene doesn't work if Paul Atreides has galaxy brain and he's acting the scene like he's, you know, Bran Stark.
Right.
So anyway, that's my little galaxy brain into this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I had a, you mentioned the Golden Path, and Anthony, I don't know if this is one point where you would want to close your ears.
Maybe. I'm going away. Give me a thumbs up when I can return.
Okay. So my understanding is a few books down, this Golden Path is the path to save humanity from extinction, correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. But my understanding, based on the numerous YouTube videos I watch, is Paul veers off the path. He actually doesn't go on the path, and it's Leto II who actually picks up the mantle to continue that journey. One, do you think Denis will follow that? And two, does Paul know that at this moment?
I think that Paul's story in Dune Part 3 will and should end the way it does in Dune Messiah with, well, I guess we don't want to spoil that, but I think it should end the same way because, yeah, it's just complete disenchantment with it all. Yeah.
I think that's the part of the story is Paul wrestling with his humanity and not being able to fully commit, where Leto II is able to, as from a childhood standpoint, he has a different set of attachments and a different sort of worldview. And so it can be more committed to it, where Paul grew up with love and affection in his life and all this stuff.
So I think it's safe to let Anthony know that this
yes.
is a tragedy.
Giving the thumbs up.
Well, that it's a tragedy though.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, right. All right. So do you think, without giving any specifics away, do you think general audiences are ready for the full story of Paul and Chani? One, do you think Denis will actually go there? And two,
yes.
Our general audience is ready for that Shakespearean drama.
I think he's amping it up even with the groundwork he's laid by showing us fiercer versions of both Chani and Irulan.
Mm-hmm.
Like we also, one of the things I liked about this movie, it was Irulan's adaptation. You know, she's in the first book, we only know of her presence because she's the one recording things, like writing little blurbs that start each chapter. And then she only really comes into the story in full at the end, like what we see at the end of the movie here, when she's just suddenly given, it's basically like, hey, honey, so you're going to marry one of these two psychos. Oh, good news. It's the less psycho.
Right.
Kind of. And here we get to see more of her dawning horror when she realizes she maybe doesn't have as much agency as she thought. Like, you know, you think being a Bene Gesserit, you are becoming this powerful witch woman. But actually, she's locked into this fate. She's, you know.
But I mean, but how can you not know that? I mean, it seems like that is one of the qualifications of being a Bene Gesserit, that you are no longer in control. You're told what kind of children you're supposed to have. You're given very specific orders by the Reverend Mothers as to where you go, what you do. It seems like if you become one, you've already given in to the idea that your life is no longer completely yours.
But isn't that reflective of, maybe this is something that Anthony can weigh in on. I don't know how you, but like when, yeah, okay. But just the idea of if someone joins a cult, they think that they're getting some greater power or purpose out of it, but often they are actually losing more than they realize until it's too late and they've lost it.
But I think this is a key difference with the Bene Gesserit, is that you're there by consent and you are given, you know, you have to, you're a willing participant and you're not a mushroom that's just kept in the dark, but you are taught galactic histories. You're taught the mission of the Bene Gesserit, and you are not just some sort of out of the way detached minion, but you are, once you sort of get to a certain point, you are fully read into a lot of what's going on. You may not have operational knowledge of everything, but you really understand you are there because you want to be part of this.
But there's a difference between understanding something and like fully grokking it, you know, to understand how that applies to your life and how that's going to restrict you. I have to bring up Wheel of Time real quick.
Absolutely.
The Aes Sedai are clearly, you know, Wheel of Time.
Bene Gesserits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wheel of Time likes Star Wars, has some very clear Dune influences, and the Aes Sedai are one of them. And these are the sorceress women, for those who don't read the books or watch the show. And they, you know, they get this immense power because they learn how to channel, and that is, and how to be powerful politically and in other ways. But at the same time, they have to swear these three oaths that literally physically restrict them. Mm-hmm. And you don't understand what that really means until you've gone that far.
Anthony, do you have any perspectives on this? Did he come back?
I don't know.
Anthony, are you there?
Oh, maybe.
He's gone.
All right, I'm back.
Okay. We waved you back a while ago, so I don't know how much you heard of this last conversation.
I heard nothing, and I'm glad that I did not.
Oh, well, sorry. We were talking about the Bene Gesserit and about... Okay, go for it.
Oh, I was just going to say, I have a couple questions for you Dune experts. Number one, I didn't pick this up on the first viewing of this movie, but I picked it up on the second viewing. Paul drinks the water of life, goes into a coma. We're supposed to think he's near to death or something. And then they find out where Choni is. Jessica uses the voice to tell one of her servants, go find her.
Right.
As if that's of paramount importance. She shows up. She kind of scolds Jessica for allowing this to take place. And then Jessica uses the voice on Choni to tell her to do the thing, you know, whatever right. it is.
Mm-hmm.
But is that she uses a tear and a drop of the water of life, puts it on his lips, and immediately he comes out of the coma. But what I heard the second watch that I didn't hear the first watch was that as that's happening, Jessica uses the voice on Paul and says, wake up.
Interesting.
I was going to ask you, was it actually like the little thing that it was, that really the teardrop of the teenage girl that wakes them up? Or was it Jessica's voice that wakes them up? Because one of them leans toward prophecy and the other one leans toward propaganda.
Right. Well, I think we're one and the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Alicia, do you remember from the book? Because I do not remember.
Well, it is the whole thing in the book where, you know, her name means Desert Spring, and you know, and that's part of the prophecy. But I think that it's absolutely, you know, there's some, I don't know if it's luck that he falls for the girl with the right name and vice versa, or if there is some sort of foresight that would happen from.
Well, and he is seeing visions of her ahead of time, right?
Mm-hmm. All the way back on Caladan. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there is some fatedness that's, or at least foreseenedness in this. But I do think that you are right that I don't think Choni believes that it was her. I think it was Jessica's voice.
Do you remember from the book, Alicia? Because I do not remember how this whole scene goes down of Paul drinking the water of life.
I mean, it's, somewhat similarly, it's, okay. you know, This isn't a big change in this. It's just that Chani's more reluctant in this version, kind of is the biggest change, I guess.
If I'm going to criticize this movie at all, it's this section that I feel is the most underdeveloped and unearned, and the one that I least understood how the plot mechanical gear points are lining up. The end battle is the end battle, you know, fighting Fade, you know, all of that, you know, that all is fine. And it's just sort of compressed together as the closing chapter. But it was this act, I don't know, third act or whatever it is, that just didn't quite work for me the same, because suddenly she's showing up on a thopter and this tear and the water of life. And she's like, to her, to the one guy, who knows of this? Only you, Reverend Mother. And then they go in, and then the place is like full of people. and like there's throngs, you know, lots of people that are there. So I don't know if it's a time compression thing, an editing thing, but this was the weakest point of the movie for me.
And I think this does relate in some way to the question of whether Paul's shift is well earned. Because you don't quite understand the passage, how to measure the passage of time.
Yeah.
At this stage of his journey. I didn't seem to trip on it, but I could see how other people could.
I didn't trip on it. It's just the one place where it was the most thin, you know, there was the most fraying or the most edges that I could kind of see. Otherwise, the time compression in the book, he's in the desert for a couple of years, you know, and his sister is born and all this kind of stuff. And in this, it's less than 9 months that they bring it all together. And it's fine. And I think it totally works in that regard.
Can I ask about it's a spoiler for the first book, so it's not a spoiler for the future movies. But the biggest change from, other than, of course, the Mentats were stripped out, but that's, I understand, Villeneuve had to focus.
And the guild was also stripped out.
And the guild. They play a bigger role in Doom Messiah, so I have to think that they'll be brought back more for that.
And just really quick, too, on the whole Southern Hemisphere thing, the Guild is very much in the books a part of why the rest of the universe can't see what's going on in the Southern Hemisphere.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, the Guild does stuff down there. The Guild is, it's politics, but there's a reasons for why the Southern Hemisphere is not just because it's wild, but there are actual choices being made by the powers of B.
I was saying that the biggest change is that Aaliyah did not kill her grandfather, which was, I didn't mind it as much as I thought I was going to going in. Although it's just such a cool way to establish that character. But do you guys think that, did you like Paul being the one to do that? Do you think that that's something that shows his character development?
I like
those of you who know in a different way.
I like that Paul did it. It was kind of weird how he did it. Like, he just walked up to him and like no one was trying to stop him or anything. And maybe because they had overpowered, you know, the Sardaukar at that point, that he could just walk up and just do what he did is something that you could question whether or not how realistic that was. But I like the fact that
more or less realistic than a 3-year-old doing it.
Right, exactly. It's definitely more realistic. Him actually doing it's more realistic, and whether or not everyone would just let him walk as casually as he did. But then again, it worked for me in the moment and watching it happen.
Yeah, as a film, for all of his changes that he's made, none of them caught me in the moment, especially in that first viewing. I didn't feel a hitch or a moment. I mean, my only Dune 1, Part 1 criticisms, which I'm well quoted on, are I didn't like the diction, and I didn't necessarily like his choice for how to play Jessica in the first movie.
Yeah, I feel like he's toned that down.
Way down, and she was fine with that, and Rebecca Ferguson owned that vision, and I thought that was well. But outside of that, there's nothing in this movie, the variances between the book and this movie, that I felt a friction point. It all made sense, and it all flowed very smoothly for me. And I can see how he's making certain choices so that he has certain options for himself available in a next movie.
One question I have, as it relates to the prophecy, I was wondering how this plays out in the book. We talked about how the Bene Gesserit are manufacturing this
belief.
Right.
Or the missionary the Protectiva or the one who can see?
I don't know any of it.
All of
it.
Yeah.
Right.
And maybe this will lead all to in the same.
Yeah.
Because on one hand they're manufacturing it, but it is coming true. Like he is exactly. able to see the future. It's, exactly. It kind of reminds me of Game of Thrones in a way, where a big aspect of Game of Thrones is the one true God versus, you know, the God of the Seven or whatever, right? And
good thing,
you know,
we got Anthony that, here to,
you know, the one that the Red Witches follow,
right?
But there is definitely some type of real magic going on as it relates to that one true God in Game of Thrones. Right.
Like people are coming back from the dead.
People are coming back from the dead.
Yeah,
miracle type things are absolutely happening, and so it's kind of similar here with regards to Dune, where there's this manufactured aspect. Even the fact that they were trying to set up Fade Rotha to possibly be the Kwisatz Haderach, you can tell they're trying to do all these machinations. Mm-hmm. But you do have people actually foretelling the future, actually able to use prescience. And I know that plays a role in the future books as well, being able to block the ability to kind of either see, to be mm-hmm. seen by people yep. who have mm-hmm. that ability, right?
Yep.
And so, how does that play out in terms of, like, Paul as a prophecy does seem to be coming true? How can you manufacture that? And I don't know if that is addressed at all.
I'd be interested to hear from Anthony on the question of gods and religion in Ice and Fire, though.
Yeah, I'm more interested. I mean, I'm happy to do an entire podcast on that if you want. It's a good question. Like, I think a better example of this would be like the Weirwood Tree Old Gods, mm-hmm. where there's like legitimate, like there's actually people in those trees.
Right. Okay.
Right. And so it's like, you know, some people just don't know how to tap into the network, but some people do. And they're actually able to do it. They can see far into the future and all that business. And these trees live forever. So they do kind of function as, you know, someone like Bran could become a deity at some point if he wanted to project his consciousness into the network.
Hmm.
You know, do a second life in the network or something like that. But here's the problem with relating this to Dune, and maybe this is just sort of my limited scope on this, but I'm wondering if the Bene Gesserit have the ability to make someone like Paul see particular visions, because that would be an amazing way to manipulate someone, you know, some new prince,
mm-hmm.
Or some duke's son or something like that. And so I'm wondering, it's like, do the Bene Gesserits believe that, are they convinced of their own prophecies, or are they generating their own prophecies?
So I think,
can it be both?
A little clarification here might help. And it's nothing that it spoilers for the rest of the books, because it's all spelled out in these first two movies. The Bene Gesserit are trying to create a male counterpart to what they are as a sisterhood.
Right.
And the thing that's important to know about the Bene Gesserit. That's
interesting. Okay.
Yeah, is not that it's magic. The voice is not magic.
Right.
They're everything that they do.
Wait a second. Amsterdam yeah. is collapsing.
Yeah.
We need to pause here.
No, I think she's okay. You okay? Alicia, I've marked this in the
No,
in
the, it's
the cats.
The cats are playing chase and they just yeah.
The cats are attacking. The cats are attacking.
Cats are getting anxious.
All right, there we go.
Are you stabilized?
Yeah, no, they're playing chase, so that's why I muted it. Anyway.
So David, say again now. The Bene Gesserit are trying to create
a male version
okay.
of themselves.
So it's like a bunch of nuns who are like, you know, we could really use some monks.
Yep.
Let's try to figure out how to create an order of monks that do the same thing as we do.
So what they do, what they have is total body awareness. So think of, you know, all of our mystique and mysticism and
that's
stories
where they
about.
They can take the
poison. But they don't want monks. They want one messiah figure
that they can control, because when they take the water of life and become a reverend mother,
yeah,
they have full genetic recall. They can literally talk to every single ancestor in their line that okay. they're related to. And so they have a giant Rolodex. And so they have this backwards awareness of all of history going back prior. So they've mm-hmm. a lot of the books talk about this whole thing of how you've got to be able to hold all these, you know, manage all these voices in your head. And
with Aaliyah, she enters her before she's even born.
So she has no training to be able to manage
pre-born.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing is they have total body awareness in the sense that they can control every muscle. They can turn on and off every nerve in their body. They are in complete control of their physical presence. So they're deadly fighters. The ability for them to strike is faster than they can hear. They can literally hear your nerves firing and can react even before you know what you're doing.
They would be such cool D&D characters.
Totally. And the voice
I mean,
is
there
not,
are tabletop RPGs.
There are, yeah. And the sure. voice is not magic. The voice is, I'm so cued into you and to your psychology mm-hmm. that
your
I can...
physiology.
Yeah, and your physiology that I can use tonality and suggestion and psychology to affect you at a sub... awareness level. I can affect your neurological system without you being aware of it. Mm. So that's how the voice works. And so because they can see backwards, they've got that point of view, but they can't, what they can't do is they can't see forwards. And every time they've tried to have a male become a Bene Gesserit and drink the water of life, it doesn't end well.
He does.
And yeah, basically. And so that's what the Kwisatz Haderach is that they've been doing this complex breeding protocol to try to find the one person who can take water of life and do the poison transmutation. So not unlike Star Wars, where they're trying to find a force-sensitive clone kind of thing. They're trying to figure out how do we get a biological... a person who can handle this particular thing. And so, Paul is premature. Paul is one generation ahead. He was supposed to be a woman who was supposed to be married to Fade Rautha, and then they were supposed to produce the Kwisatz Haderach. Mm.
Right. So they have this issue of talking about control. Like, okay, so Fade Rautha is a horrible, you know, murderous That's cannibal. But we can control him because he is subject to his base sexual desires, things like that. Whereas, you know, Paul, he was supposed to be a female, but his mother would not be controlled. She decided her love for the Duke and wanting to give him the son he wanted was more important than following the Bene Gesserit. So now he's even less able to be controlled because, you know, he's raised by this woman.
And as an Atreides, he was schooled in weapons and tactics with one of the best swordsmen in the world. And the Mentats, which are human computers. So there's this thing in the Dune history, the prehistory, called the Butlerian Jihad, where they got rid of thinking machines. So humans have become computers. And so they drink a spice-infused liquid that helps speed up their mind. And he was taught Bene Gesserit skills by the Lady Jessica. So he has, you know, a noble ancestry, computer mindset, and Bene Gesserit, Prana Bindu, you know, all this extra teaching. And so he is something that they didn't plan for, but Lady Jessica had created for his love for the Duke.
So I have a question. Is it that the prophecy of the Lisan al-Ghaib just happened to correspond with the Kwisatz Haderach that the Bene Gesserit were trying to create? Or were they actually, did they actually infuse this prophecy into their Fremen culture?
They infused it for that, to later play it out with their own Kwisatz Haderach. And they didn't intend it for it to be Paul, but they did intend to use this prophecy
Yep. But all the specific things that Lisa and Al-Ghaib was supposed to do, like he's going to know your ways, he's going to do all these things. Mm-hmm. Was that infused by the Bene Gesserit, or was that something that the Fremen culture?
Well, that's probably from his teaching that he's just so, in the book, you especially see from his perspective a lot how keenly observant he is. So he's just, because of he was trained as a mentat, because and Bene Gesserit and all these things combined together, you know, he just sees how Stilgar has his suit, and he intuitively is like, oh, okay, well, that must be how it's done.
No, I know that, but the Fremen have a prophecy that the Lisa right. and Al-Ghaib will do these things. Mm-hmm. So my question is that prophecy of him being able to do all these things something that the Bene Gesserit put into the Fremen? Because even the 1984 yes. Dune mentions that. It is.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. I think we're getting close to our exit point here. So I feel like we could probably talk for another hour very easily.
Can I ask one question here?
Sure. Yeah.
All right. This is a question for my son.
Okay.
This is a question that the youth are asking online.
There was a bunch of teenagers in my theater last night. I'm really wondering how this is resonating with them. Yeah. Go ahead.
Have any of you seen Attack on Titan?
No, but I've heard about it.
No, I'm aware
right. of the anime, it. Right?
Yeah, yeah. So he wanted to ask, who's a more well-written character, Paul Atreides, Anakin Skywalker, or Aaron Yeager? Mm. And I was like, I don't know, man. I have I can't answer that
you
one.
You have to ask your Discord because members.
I think that the reason he's asking is that he's seen a lot of the Paul Atreides in those other characters.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Or you could say Randall Thor from Wheel of Time. Or Yeah.
All right. Okay. So anyway, that was his big question. Sorry, Baron. We
failed you.
We failed you.
I'm sure somebody out there has the answer to that. Yeah. Sure. I had the distinct feeling last night when I was watching it, when I was at the theater for my second viewing, that when this comes out in video on demand, I want to do like a scene by scene conversation of this, because there's so much more that we could have conversation around and about. But I really just had a great time talking today, and thank you guys all for very much for showing up.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts, Anthony, that you have? And we'll go around with everybody. Just any final...
Yeah, I just, as someone who's not well-versed in the Dune universe, I feel like my entire life is a complete fraud. I feel like Star Wars stole all of its good ideas from Dune.
And other and things.
I've been sitting here... I feel like I've just been eating fast food my whole life. With Star Wars, and this is like actual a Michelin star restaurant for sci-fi connoisseurs.
But you know what? Sometimes like the over the counter pizza is good. You don't always have to go to Naples.
That's right. Oh, we're losing you a little bit. We've got Anthony on lag a little bit there. Yeah. So, Ron, any close up thoughts for you?
Yeah, this is once again. Thanks for having me on. I think I love movies and stories like this that have such profound themes like religion and leadership and the dangers of following charismatic leaders mm-hmm. too much, mm-hmm. which I think are all played out in this movie and in Dune stories. I'm very interested to see how Denis takes part the next one, where he takes it, if he'll be able to make it interesting. Because my understanding of Messiah, there's a lot less action in Messiah, right?
We'll see what he does. In the book, there's not a lot of off-world action.
Right. So be curious.
I think I think we might see some of, because in the books, it just kind of picks up after this war plays out.
Yep.
And I think we might see more of the war. Because.
That's a good point. So,
yeah.
Speaking of which, if Paul had lost that fight, what would they have done?
They would have
said, okay, we lost. We'll go back to the south.
From the Bene Gesserit, they were like happy to follow Feyd Rautha. And I saw someone actually arguing that it would be better for everyone if Feyd Rautha had won because there wouldn't be the war. I was like, no, I think it would be faster and uglier, even.
Yeah, I think so. Probably. Without control, it would be an out of control Steve for sure. If you've listened to this podcast, you've seen the movie. So we told you right up at the front. I hope you've come back and seen this. And I'm just really interested to see how this is going to, this is going to be like a cultural inflection point, because suddenly there's a whole new group of people who are going to be coming to the, this material. It's all over social media. The memes are all out there. So I'm really fascinated to see how this is an inflection point for us. And I'm really interested to see, hopefully it's not going to be more than a couple of years until the next movie is out. I'm pretty excited. And I was really glad to be able to talk with all of you. And I hope we can do it again some point. Alicia, last word, close us out.
Yeah, I think that the script and the music for part three is already done. We just need an official out loud green light so they can start filming soonish. I think, you know, they're just wrapping up some pre-production stuff, but I'm completely turned around from, you know, being iffy on part one, and now I'm all in on part two. Can't wait for part three. Just so excited to have this as a Dune fan, as a film fan, and can't wait to go back and see it again. I hope it stays actually in the theater for a while so that I can see it in Dolby.
Yeah, I really need to go see it on.
And they will re-release it before the Oscars next year.
Yeah,
so, you
know, that's a good point.
It's going to get all the nominations.
That's right. Well, everyone, thank you so very much. I had a really great time today. I'll do a outro on my own and cut everyone loose. But Ron Dawson, thank you very much. Alicia, we will see. Absolutely. We'll see you again very soon. Anthony, always a pleasure. I know you've been busy, but it's good to hear your voice. And
sure thing.
Yeah, we'll talk to everyone soon.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, well, I hope you have enjoyed that conversation. I'm here just by myself to record the outgoing credits. Thank you again to Alicia, Ron, and Anthony. As a podcaster, this is the kind of thing that I live for. I love these deep conversations where we can have broad-ranging perspectives and changes of views and talk about the things that we really enjoy. I really am looking forward to doing a full movie review, like doing scene by scene, because it's just so rich. But we'll see when that comes out on video on demand. We'll hopefully do that. Just really quickly wrapping up the podcast, if you're interested in supporting these kinds of conversations, in supporting the various creators that we work with and helping us with all of the different software and platforms that we need to pay for, we would love to have your support. You can do that either through Supercast or Patreon. There are links in the show notes below, or visit us at our website, lorehounds.com. As always, you can email us at thelorehounds.com. If you want to join the conversation in real time and hang out with like-minded individuals and share notes on the different movies and television shows and books that that inspire you and bring you joy to your life, then join us on the Discord. It's a great community. We have a great moderator team. We've got channels set up for all of the different shows and projects and things that we're covering. We also have all of our affiliates. Anthony and Alicia both have their own podcasts. Alicia is at Woolshift Dust, but she's going to be spinning up some new stuff. She's got some Star Wars stuff in the pipeline. Anthony has Properly Howard Movie Review with his buddy Anthony, and they do old movies. And then we're going to be doing Severance coverage with Anthony and Steve once we know when Severance 2 is coming out. And also, if you know Marilyn Arpaquila, our favorite Tolkien scholar, she just started up her own podcast called Rings and Rituals. You got to go to the show notes. You got to look for the link there and then go subscribe to it, or again, go to our website. And they're looking at all of the rituals that are embedded in season one of The Rings of Power and looking at how ritual plays an important part in our daily lives. We are in the middle of doing our Shogun coverage, and we've got lots on the plate for this summer. It's going to be very busy with The Acolyte, The Boys, The Bear, House of the Dragon. Lastly, just a shout out to all of the people who do support us at the top tier levels, our Discord server boosters, Opus the Machine, Gnarls, Aaron K, Tiller the Thriller, and Dork of the Ninjas. To our Lore Master subscribers, our top tier Patreon subscribers, Patreon and Supercast subscribers, Samartian, Mark H, Michael G, Michelle E, David W, Brian P, Nick W, SC, Peter OH, Bettina W, Adam S, Nancy
Nancy M., Duve 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H., Sarah L., Gareth C., Eric F., Matthew M., Sarah M., DJ Miwa, Andra B., Kwong Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T., Alex V., Aaron T., Sub-Zero, Aaron K., Dally V21, Gnarls, and everlast but never least, Adrienne. Thank you all so very much. We'll see you on the next one.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.